remind me next lecture to put the other one on as well. Yeah. It just means I have to press two things instead of one, but I can manage that. Okay. We still have 1 minute to go, so you can carry on chatting if you like, or fall asleep for 1 minute. Okay, time to wake up and time to shut up. Not being rude, you understand. Welcome back again. Good news is the microphone now works, so I won't have to shout, which is good. I hope you can hear me at the back still. It's not a silly question, I can't tell, but okay, great. All right, so what we're going to do today is, first of all, just a quick reminder of our very useful notation, the asymptotic growth notation that I introduced last time. So just very quickly to remind you, and then one or two examples here. So remember, big O gives us upper bounds on the growth of functions, and we focus on the dependency on the variable. Okay. So to say that f is big O of g means you can find an n0 in n and a real number c strictly bigger than 0, remember, okay, with the property that for all n bigger than 0, the value of f at n is no bigger than the constant times the value of g at n. That's exactly what it means. And if you're asked to prove something from first principles, that means expand into this definition and use this definition, as my two tutorial groups will certainly know by now. And I hope everybody knows. Yeah, clear enough? You know, if you're asked to prove from first principles, what else do you have but the definition? Okay. Once we get past this initial introductory phase, we can use the more souped-up theorems to avoid all this tedium. But you've got to go through this to understand what it's doing for you. Okay. Big omega does the analogous job, but for a lower bound. Okay. So to say that f is big omega of g is to say that, again, you have those constants, etc., that the value of f is bounded from below by some constant times the value of g. Note the symmetry of the definitions here. Okay, and I hope you've all proved for yourselves that f is big O of g if and only if g is big O omega of f, yeah? Which I asked you to do last time, okay? And I remind you that big theta just says it's both, okay? So basically, if you say f is big theta of g, you're saying that g doesn't overestimate the growth rate and doesn't underestimate it. They have the same growth rate. The constants involved may be different, okay? So the constants for the upper bound may be 1c, and the constant for the lower bound some other c, right? They're not the same constants, but you can adjust so that you've got the values of f sandwiched between versions of g appropriately magnified, okay? And just to remind you, this n0 business is just a settling in period of atypical behavior. So let's just go back to an example I showed you in lecture one, which was an illustration of linear search as opposed to binary search. Okay. By the way, if you haven't met binary search before, I did remind you, or I pointed out to you what it was in lecture one, and we'll be coming back to ideas like that later on, and we'll be looking at them in more detail. So don't get too worried if you haven't met it before. It's in the notes anyway. Just make sure you understand what it is. Okay. Now, I showed you the graphs of the runtimes, okay, like that. You see that's the linear search, and the green line barely off the bottom line is the binary search. Okay. And if we look at the individual graphs, which, is that, okay, well, good, that's showing up well, okay. You see that you can see the behavior very easily. It's a straight line, as you would expect. Not from the name of the search, just from the way the algorithm works, okay? If we look at the binary search graph, that's what it looks like. If you can discern a pattern there, you're better than me, okay? Okay, it's kind of increasing, but, you know, is it logarithmic, is it quadratic? You can't see. And the reason for that is very simple. We haven't gone far enough to see the behavior as depending on the variable n, as opposed to the cost of setting up variables, initialize them, the loop, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, all the noise is drowning out the behavior. And that's not hard to understand. Why? Because, remember, binary search, although I introduced it in a recursive fashion, you can implement it as a loop in a very simple way. And any compiler worth his name would actually remove the tail recursion and replace it by a loop, which is what I've done manually. And the number of times the loop is executed is basically log n, where n is the size of the array. Now, these experiments go from 200 to 20,000. That sounds like a very big array. It is. But how many iterations of the loop is that? Now, I'm sure you all know log to the base 2 of 20,000, don't you? Well, if you've forgotten, because, you know, okay, you're young, and it's just about 14, you know. That's nothing, right? And the amount of work it does in each iteration is minimal. It's just, you know, comparisons. That's it, yeah. So there hasn't been time for us to see the behavior of a binary search as dependent on n rather than just the inevitable setup costs. So we're not out of the initial settling in period. So that's what it means in practice in terms of algorithmic analysis. I hope that's made the idea very clear to you. Is that, yeah? Okay, good. While I'm about it, let's enjoy a couple of other things, I think, very quickly. So this is looking at, let me just move this. Okay, I should have made this bigger. That's better, okay? Just illustrate, we looked at various functions last time as illustrations using the notation. Here they are seen graphically. Okay, so the first one is looking at 3nq plus 8 as opposed to some positive constant times n cubed. We saw that 3nq plus 8 is big O of n cubed and is also big omega of n cubed. Okay, what does it look like as a graph? Well, we can see, and this is going to take various values of c from 3 to 11, okay? As an animation, and if I get it going, okay. So just now c equals 3, and you see the green line is always below the red line. Okay. No surprise, 3n cubed is always less than 3n cubed plus 8. It doesn't take a genius to work that out. Okay. Now as c increases even slightly, you just see, okay, and as you make c bigger, the effect kicks in earlier, okay, as we saw from the analysis, yeah? Okay. Now, if we look at the next one is, let me just move it up. We're looking at n versus log to the base 2 of n versus log to the base 2 of n all squared, okay? What does that look like? Well, I hope you know what you're expecting. Log n log squared n should be below n, and pretty early on. Okay, and indeed, that's exactly it. You can see log n is you know, small immediately. Log squared n takes a bit of time, but then it just falls below and then just, you know, shoots away. Okay, and that would happen no matter what part of log n you plot it. It would take a bit longer, but eventually the straight line, it grows significantly faster, well, exponentially faster than the part of log n. Okay, and just for a final illustration, there's two more, sorry. Just if we look at this complicated function that we analyzed, 871 n cubed plus 13 n squared log n to the fifth plus 18 n plus 500. I'm sure you remember that, yes, you know. You've all memorized that, yeah? And we compared it to cn cubed and showed that it's, you know, bounded from above by cn cubed. Well, I'm taking constants from 1 up to 2,000 just to see what happens. Remember, we had a rather big constant in our analysis. So if we initially the constant is way too small, and you can see that, you know, we're not. So the green curve will eventually overcome the red one, but we start with a constant that's just too small. Okay, let's just get this to. And you can see that as we take the it's only the constant that we're changing, comparing the two graphs. Okay, yeah. And so the constant doesn't have to be very big before we overcome the curve. And the bigger the constant, of course, the earlier on we overcome the red curve. Surprise, surprise. Okay. And just finally, which is relevant to what we did for linear versus binary search, if we look at 10n plus 10 versus a log base 2 of n plus a, and I'm going to set A to be from 100 to 200. How do these two compare? Well, by now you should know what to expect, okay? This is starting off with the initial value of A. If we just get it to vary A, you can see that, of course, as A gets bigger, so we're looking A log N plus A, we're making the value of that bigger, but only by constant multiples, okay? Whatever value of A is, we're always going to be below the red line. It's just that it may take a bit longer before we get below it, okay? Yeah. So I hope that's helped a little bit to make these ideas a bit more concrete. I should point out that these kind of illustrations don't prove anything. Why not? Because you can only ever see a finite amount of the graph. How do you know that the plotter is actually correct? All kinds of things like that. But the basic difficulty is you can only ever see a finite amount of it. But they're very helpful in making the ideas concrete. And if in a very complicated situation, we're not quite sure what the constants ought to be or where the behavior starts, plot a graph, see it, formulate a conjecture, and then prove your conjecture by going to the definitions. Okay, a very good way to work. Okay, going back to our slide. So I hope that's made those definitions a little bit more concrete for you. Okay. The only way to make them really work for you is to work with them and absorb them so they're second nature. Okay. And I can't do that for you. You have to do that for yourselves. Okay. Just a reminder, I did introduce the notion of worst-case runtime. Just to remind you again, the worst-case running time of an algorithm A is that function TA that takes a natural number representing input size and gives us back, let's say, a natural number representing number of computation steps, or you could do it as a real number representing actual running time. It doesn't matter, okay? It gives you a measure of how much time it takes to run, okay? And TAN is divided with the maximum number of computation steps performed by A over all inputs of size N. Okay, now, remember, we insist that when you define an input size, there are only finitely many inputs of a given fixed size. Okay? So this maximum will always exist because you're only looking at the finite number of runtimes, so there's a maximum. If there was an infinite number of runtimes, there might not be a maximum. It might just always increase to infinity. Okay? So this definition makes sense. It's well-defined. I'll draw a diagram here, which I will use later. So if I start to rub it out, shout. Okay. Just to illustrate this, if I was to fix N, just for the sake of argument, and then look at, let's say there are five inputs of size N, whatever N may be. Okay, just so I don't get the cluttered diagram. Okay, so let's say input one has a runtime up to there. Okay, so this is time, this is input size. Yeah. Maybe input 2 has a runtime up to there. Maybe input 3 has a runtime up to there. Input 4 perhaps to here. And maybe input 5, same as that, okay? What's my worst case runtime? Well, there it is, okay? That's just as simple as that. There's nothing very clever about this idea, right? You know, this is a good way to make these ideas concrete, by the way. Okay? Don't just read the symbols. Understand them, absorb them, draw diagrams, as long as they're correct. Okay. It's a very good way. Okay, I'll tell you the story. I was once reading a book on algebraic curves, and I think I read the first 8 chapters about 12 times. Now, that's not because I'm thick. Maybe I am, but that's not the reason I read those 8 times. Every time I read them, I understood more and saw more why things as they are, rather than just, well, here's the proof, end of it. I wanted to know, why does the situation work this way? Why should I expect it to be this and not something else? Okay. And the more you read it, the more you dig into it, the more you get out. Now, these notes are not anywhere near so complicated, so don't panic. But the point is, when you're reading something, it's no good just reading it, it's no good just memorizing it. You have got to understand it, absorb it, make it your own. That's when you understood the subject. That applies to any subject, not just this one. Okay. Right, so I hope that's made this very clear. Yeah. We will introduce a bit of a joke concept, actually, but it will help us in one or two illustrations. The best case running time is, here we looked at the maximum, we look at the minimum. You know, what's the best you could expect for size n? Okay. It's not a very useful measure, to be honest, but it's helpful in some illustrations. That's all it is. So it's the same definition, but you take the minimum instead of the maximum. Okay. I stress, we only really use this idea just for explanatory purposes. It's not a serious measure of runtime. It'll be the shyster salesman's measure, but not ours, okay, if you'll pardon the expression. Okay, so how do we apply big O, big omega, and theta to analyze the running time of an algorithm? Well, one way to do it would be we analyze the algorithm to obtain its worst-case running time function, TA of n. Now, remember, that's going to involve quite a lot of unknown constants, right? Because how long it takes to execute some fixed statement depends on your machine architecture, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? But that's a possible approach. Okay? We do that, and then we use that expression involving all those constants to bound it from above by big O and from below by big omega, and hope that we've done things as, you know, as tight as possible. Okay? Now, this approach can only work for very simple algorithms. We'll see one example. I stress this now because this is not the approach that we would take. It's not the approach I will allow you to use. Okay? But it's a good starting point to introduce some ideas. Okay? It's not a seriously feasible approach, as we'll see, okay? Except for very simple situations, as I've said. Okay? In fact, what we do is use asymptotic notation along with the analysis, okay, to avoid having to name all those constants. Why name them? They're going to disappear in the end anyway. You don't know what they are. All you know is that the constant plus a constant is a constant. That sort of thing, okay? And our aim in an analysis is to have a matching big O and omega expression so that then we have a theta analysis. Yeah? So we know that the worst case running time is no worse than this and actually also no better than this. We haven't overestimated it. We haven't underestimated it in terms of growth rates, okay? We can't give the actual values because we don't know all those constants, but we can give the growth rate. Okay. This is very attractive, but unfortunately, it's surprising how often it is not possible. Even for algorithms that look quite simple, we cannot get matching expressions. It's just too complicated. Computing is an inherently tough process to analyze, as I'm sure you've already decided. Okay. If you haven't, now's the time to take my word for it, and then you'll see it. Okay? Yeah. Don't panic. This is an example to illustrate why the simple-minded approach can't possibly be a serious one to use in all situations. Let's look at this algorithm, and let's not worry about what it does. Just look at the shape of it, okay? We have some double loop here. We compute, so A is an array, R and S are indices, okay? We compute the midpoint of the array so far. We call an algorithm B on the upper and lower half from that midpoint. After that returns, we compute the midpoint based on the supplied indices to the array at the top level call. We call the algorithm A recursively on the upper and lower half of that. Okay, and that, of course, initiates other calls to algorithm B. What does algorithm B do? Well, it does a simple comparison and swap if possible, and then it says, oh, if R is not too big, oh, I'll call algorithm A again on indices R and S minus R. Okay, now, I don't think you need a lot of convincing that if you try to analyze this line by line, giving them constants and tracing exactly what's up, you're not going to get anywhere. Yes? Okay. We need something better than that. But we'll start from that in a simple situation and work to a situation where writing an expression that gives you the runtime of this is actually very easy. Okay. I won't come back to this algorithm because it doesn't do anything very interesting. I just wrote it to, you know, convolutely enough for you to see that a naive approach isn't going to work. And by the way, we have algorithms which are much more complicated than this of genuine importance in practice. Right? This is just an illustrative thing that could fit on the slide. Okay, let's go back to something easy, okay, because we want to illustrate those ideas just so you get used to them, get used to working with them, and then once you're used to that, we can go to more interesting situations. So I stress, it's not that we're seriously concerned about the performance of linear search. It's pretty obvious, right? You know, nobody's going to waste time developing a theory just to analyze something so trivial. But it's a good place to start if you're just getting used to the ideas. So that's why it's here. So I remind you, linear search is the very simple idea. I supply an array A of, let's say, integers, and a search integer. I want to say if integer K is in the array A, and what do? You look if K is in location 0, or the first location. If it's there, fine. If it's not, look in the next location. If it's there, fine. Otherwise, next, next. If you don't find it at all, by the time you've run out of the array, you can say, well, it's not there. Obviously, a correct algorithm, okay? The analysis of this. Now, this is the point to mention some assumptions we're going to make, which are essentially simplifying assumptions to make the whole process a bit less messy, so that you can grasp the basic principles as opposed to worrying too much about a lot of detail, which ultimately doesn't really matter very much. Okay, but that's just my word for it, okay, which you're welcome to, well, you'll have to take my word for it, basically, or do all the stuff yourself. Okay, so our assumption is going to be that in pseudocode, we're writing in such a way that each line executed once takes a constant amount of time. It may be executed lots of time, okay, but the one execution is a constant, okay? And then we have to account for how many times it's executed. Now, it is very much a simplifying assumption, because if you look at line one, for example, it says for I equals 0 to the length of a minus 1. Now, of course, when I is 0, that does take constant time. When I is 2, it's constant time. But when you get up to the length of n, that's not a constant. So strictly speaking, we were to be accounting for the cost of that. But to be honest, if we did that, it gets very messy. And at the end of the day, the extra cost is noise in the overall analysis. So it's a simplifying assumption. I mentioned this objection so that you're not, you know, confused that we've overlooked something. It's just a way of avoiding a lot of quite tedious detail. Okay? If we want to take account of everything, we should really propose a formal model of computation in which we account for every step. We can do that, but it's not pleasant. Okay, so we're going to assume that lines 1, 2, 3, and 4 each take a constant time to execute once. Okay, so for this very simple exercise, let's give those constants names. And with absolute ingenuity, we'll call this constant C1, C2, C3, and C4. That's been the cost of each line. Okay, you can see how the constants, you know, increase endlessly in this approach. So it's only doable because this is so simple. Okay, and then note one gives you the actual detail of such an analysis. I won't go through it here because I can't really add anything of interest to it. Just read the notes, okay? And you can see that the worst case of lint search satisfies these horrible expressions here. Okay. The only observation to make is you see each time you execute this loop, that line is executed. If this line is ever executed, you finished, okay? So lines 3 and 4 are executed only once. You only execute line 4 if you've never returned from here, okay? So that's what these expressions are. They've collected all the stuff and so on. Okay, it's all in the notes. Very simple stuff. I will leave you to read that for yourselves. Okay. So we have those expressions there. Draw your attention to, before we go on to this, so our conclusion from all these constants and so on is, well, the worst case is like some constant times n, plus the maximum some constant with some constant. And we've given all those constants names. We don't know what the constants are. Okay. So we've worked with all those constants very minutely and so on, only to come up with something that says, well, that's a constant and that's a constant. Okay. Feels like a lot of work just, you know, to name all of them, keep track of them, and just to say, well, you know, they're constants. Okay, I'll come back to that point. Okay, but for now, let's just carry on. What's the best time for lint search? Well, it's when you find, easy to see, when you find what you're looking for straight away. Right? So you execute line one, line two, succeeds, line 3, end of story. So the best case is a constant, C1 plus C2 plus C3. Okay. Now, we can plot graphs of this. We don't know what the constants are, but if we give them various values just to see how the thing behaves, it's not very difficult to see. The best case is always, of course, just a constant, which goes up and down according to what these are, but it's always a, you know, flat line. Okay. And lint search is always a straight line. Where it starts along here depends on what value you give those constants. We don't know what they are, but we know that there are some constants. The shape is always going to be a straight line, of course. That's the point. Okay. All right. Well, let's just prove formally that T of lint search is big O of n, just to satisfy ourselves. And this is a very easy thing to do, but let's go through it, just so you see an example. Okay. Well, we just seen that T of lint search n is at most C1 plus C2n plus the maximum of those two constant expressions. All right, well, let's take n0 to the maximum here, okay? Right. And I'll take C to be C1 plus C2 plus 1. You'll see why in a moment, okay? And then you think, how did you find those in the first place? It wasn't just a guess, was it? What am I heading towards? I want to head towards an expression that T of lint search is less than or equal to some constant times n for all sufficiently large values of n, okay? And I work backwards from that. Only I'm not showing you the backwards working. You have to reconstruct it. That's another way in which you are actively engaged with reading the material. Well, for every n bigger than or equal to n, 0, we now have T of Lin search n is no more than C1 plus C2 times n plus n0, because n0 is always at least as big as this. Okay? Right. Well, since n is bigger than or equal to n0, this is no bigger than replacing n0 with n. Okay? That's another upper bound. And now you just collect into the brackets, so you get C1 plus C2 plus 1 times n, and that's what I call my C. Ta-ra! Are you impressed? No, I hope not. It's a triviality, but you should be able to do these trivialities, okay? Don't dismiss it unless you can really do it, okay? Yeah? Very easy, though. I hope you can see it. There's nothing clever going on here. Okay. So it's big O of n, okay? So we know that, but of course it's also big O of n log n, because n log n is bigger than n, and big O of n squared, and so on. So how do we know that big O of n is not an overestimate? I know it's pretty obvious from the code, but, you know, in other situations it's not obvious. How can we prove that we haven't overestimated the worst-case running time? Well, we supply a big omega bound, a lower bound, which is also of the form n. Okay. I think I'm going to get rid of these dramatic pauses because I inherited some of these slides, and I think. Okay, never mind. A bit embarrassing, really. I think we should have something more interesting than, you know. But never mind. I'll get an explosion going next time. Okay. T of Lin search n is also big omega of n. So that proves that, you know, the big O of n was not an overestimate. You can't do any better than that in terms of growth rates. And the proof is now an even bigger triviality. Why? Because T of Lin search n is at least as big as C1 plus C2 times n. Because remember, it was at least as big as that plus a positive constant. So dropping the positive constant doesn't increase the value, it decreases it again. End of proof. Okay. It's that simple. Okay? Just take those. Okay. This brings up a point which I will not rub this out. I said I wouldn't. Okay? A little question for all of you. If I take a function tn of the form an plus b, okay, where a is bigger than 0, okay, prove that it is big omega of n, whatever the constants a and b are, as long as a is bigger than 0, of course. Okay? Right. How would you go about doing that? Okay. If you start imitating that proof straight away and drop the b, then you weren't at this morning's and afternoon's tutorials of mine, because you're thinking straight, what if b is negative? Okay, there's a problem. Okay. So I won't do it now. If I have time at the end, I'll do it. Otherwise, I'll fit it in at the next lecture. But have a look at that if I don't get time to look at it. Okay, show that that is also big omega of n. It's also big O of n, of course. All right, let's just carry on with this. I don't want to run out of time with this. So, okay, so conclusion of this deep analysis is that T of Lin search is big theta of n, a result which is entirely obvious from the code, but I stress this is only illustrative of the process. Okay. All right. And of course, with this, we could succeed by naming all those constants because it is so simple. We will not do this again, okay, because it's not the way to analyze algorithms, honestly. Okay, a couple of things to make sure you are aware of and you never fall into these things. There are some misconceptions about big O and big omega. The first one is, it says the reasoning goes as follows. Well, it's not reasoning. It's not reasoning. It's delusion. Okay. The delusion is as follows. If we can show that TA of n is big O of fn for some function f, okay, then the running time of A on inputs of size n is bounded by f of n for sufficiently large n. Sounds really good. Nonsense, of course. It's forgetting that big O of fn involves a multiplicative constant. Yeah. So going back to what we just had, we're only guaranteed the upper bound for c times f of n, for some constant c. That constant may be 1,000, 2,000, 3 million, a half, we don't know. Yeah. So such a conclusion is obviously nonsense. And we can see it as regards our linear search example. We could have shown by exactly the same reasoning that T of Lin search is big O over half C1 plus C2 times n. Yeah, the same reasoning would show that. But of course, it's always, and also we could show that it's big O of alpha n for any constant alpha bigger than 0. But of course, T of Lin search is never less than that, because T of Lin search is at least as big as C1 plus C2 times n plus a positive constant. Yeah. So that's just, this is really very silly. It's just forgetting that big O of fn involves a magnifying constant. Okay. So you're never going to make this mistake, are you? I don't see enough shaking of heads. Come on. Wake up. All right. Next one. A bit more difficult, this one, but still actually an equally silly mistake to make. Okay. Says the following. Because T, if we have T of n is big O of fn, then we know that C times fn is an upper bound on the running time of A for all inputs of size n. That's true. Right? That's obviously true. Okay. By the definitions. Remember, T of n is the maximum runtime. You've shown that it's never bigger than C times F of n. So everything, all other runtimes of size n are below that. So that's true. Therefore, by analogy, the analogy of the self-deluded fool, I'm trying to make you feel insulted so you remember this, by the way, in case you're not familiar with the teaching technique here. I mean you! whoever. Okay. Yeah. Then, if TA of n is big omega of gn, it follows that every running time is at least as big as some constant times g of n. That's obviously nonsense. Why? Remember, TA of n is the worst case runtime. Here is the diagram I'd remember to live up, okay? For this input size, what is TA of n? It's this, yes? Now, a big O expression for it is anything that puts these below that line. Okay, so any line that starts from here and goes upwards gives us an upper bound on the runtimes, yes? And of course, if these maxima are below that line, so is everything else. Surprise, surprise, right? Now, a big omega bound is a lower bound on these maxima, right? By definition. That's what the worst case runtime is. So a lower bound is any line that starts from here and works its way downwards, right? Now, if I give you a valid lower bound to these, is it going to be a lower bound to all of these? Obviously not, right? You know, this is a lower bound for these, but these are all, you know, this lower bound is bigger than any of these, right? Yes? It's that simple, okay? Now, the problem is people confuse the situation in two ways. One is they think that this delusion is something to do with the definition of big O and big omega. Nothing to do with that at all, in the sense of the definitions are perfectly symmetrical. One is an upper bound, the other is a lower bound. The asymmetry of the situation comes from what you're bounding. We're putting an upper bound on a maximum value from a set of things. Okay? Now, obviously, an upper bound on a maximum is an upper bound on everything else within that set. But a lower bound on a maximum is not going to be a lower bound on everything else in the set. Come on, think about it. Yeah? Front row, various heights, okay? I don't know what you are, but, you know, various heights. If I say nobody's higher than 2 meters, that's safe and that's fine. Or nobody's higher than the highest person, that's fine. If I say there's at least one person who's at least this high, that doesn't say that everybody else is at least that high. Yeah? It's as simple as that. Has everybody got the idea? You will never make this stupid mistake, will you? Will you? Well, not when I'm around, okay? It's really very simple. I stress this because what happens is a kind of impressionistic understanding of the definitions rather than a proper, genuine, technical understanding of what they're saying. Okay? And if you're making these mistakes, it's because you haven't truly absorbed the definitions so that they're second nature. Okay. And that's really quite important to avoid. Anyway, I've done this bit, so I won't. Okay. Let's move on to another algorithm, slightly above linear sort, okay, or in interest and so on. This is what's called insertion, linear search, sorry. This is called insertion sort. Now I can grab this out, because we need another diagram. And insertion sort is another very simple idea to sort an array of, let's say, integers, just to make it definite, okay? Could be any set of things on which you have a known order, okay? And the idea is the following very simple notion. Okay. I'm going to focus on initial sections of the array and make those initial sections sorted and then grow the section by one place. Okay. So if I keep growing it by one place and everything up to this point is sorted, then of course by the time I've got to the end, the whole array is sorted. Clear? Okay. Well, can you tell me an initial section of this array which is always sorted? the first entry. It's always sorted, okay? So, hooray, we're off the ground, okay? Right? So that's the induction step, okay? We can always have a section. Now, suppose I've sorted up to, I see, this is the clever bit. Suppose I've sorted everything up to here. Oh, not a very good, okay? Yeah? And I now want to grow it to index j. So everything here is sorted, but this may be out of place. And of course, this I don't know about yet. But I'm going to make sure that I can grow the array to be sorted all the way up to here. Okay. What's a simple way to do that? Well, look at the entry in here. That's what I call, I think, A in there. Yes. Let's call the entry there A. Okay. Compare it to the entry just before. If A is bigger than that entry, what can you say straight away? Everything is sorted. Hooray! Hit the jackpot. If this entry is bigger than A, it has to come above A in the order. So we move it up one. That's that thing there, okay? Move it up one. So now we look at this entry and say, so A could go here, but we don't put it here just yet. Why? Because, of course, it should only go there if the entry here is in the right place compared to A. So we'll compare A with that, okay? If A is bigger than that, we're finished. If it's not, we move that up one, okay? And you get the idea. Of course, eventually you must stop, because when you get down to here, if you moved everything up, then A can go there safely. A is the smallest thing. Clear? It's as clever as that, this algorithm. Okay? That's all it does. Hence the name insertion sort. You're basically finding out where to insert the current entry so as to grow the sorted part of the array. Okay? So once that's finished, so that's the while loop there. You see, that's what that's doing, is this bit of find out where A goes, okay, for a given J. Okay? When you finish that, then you're ready to look at the next portion up of the array, and next, 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 yeah? Very simple algorithm. That's what the pseudocode does. Okay, but note that that's a nice way to understand what it does. Okay, so when you see a bit of pseudocode working on some array, try and understand it in some pictorial way as well. That really helps to gel the ideas. You can't always do it, but you can do it for a surprisingly large number of things. Okay, well, what's my next slide? I've forgotten. Oh yeah, it's an illustration of this. Sorry, yes, I might as well go through this. Okay, so here's also another way to understand the algorithm. Simulated on some smallish input. Obviously, don't put some huge input, because this, you know, it's going to take ages. So let's put this array 36514 in there. We start off, of course, looking. That's sorted, and we're looking at there to see, is that in the right place? We compare 6 with 3. That's okay, nothing to do. So finished on that. So now we move up one place, compare 5 with 6. They're in the wrong relative position. So 6 moves up one place. We go down to there, we compare 5 with 3, hooray, finished. Okay? So that's grown the array up to here, okay? And now we go up to the next place, looking at 1. You compare 1 with 6, wrong place, 1 with 5, wrong place, 1, blah, blah. You get all the way down, everything shifts up 1, okay? And then 1 goes into the first position. You get the idea out, okay? Yeah, clear enough. Okay. What's the runtime of this thing? I won't put the next slide up, because I decided it's not a very good way to do it. I'll do it live from here, and let's hope this all works out, okay? How do we analyze an algorithm like this? We could do, we're not going to go down the route of naming the constants, because you know that that's a really bad way to do it. It's just going to be annoying and tedious and boring, and can't be bothered with that, okay? Let's think about how to do this in a nicer way. Okay. Well, let me, because you see we've got this while loop inside here, okay, we have to worry about the cost of that as this is executed, okay? But let's just see this. Let's, for the time being, look at this body here as a function of j. J goes from 1 up to n, okay? So let's just look at what this costs expressed in terms of j, okay? So think of j as our variable for now, okay? And then we'll worry about the different values that j takes. Is that clear? Okay, so as a function of j, okay, well, that takes, I hate these motor things. Okay, well, line 1, what does that cost? Not 1, but order 1, constant. Yeah. Actually, theta 1, but we're going for an upper band here, okay, yeah? Line 2, again, is order 1. Remember, order 1 denotes something bounded by a constant, yeah? Okay. Now, the while loop What does that cost? Well, let's think about it. The body is executed at most how many times?
J.
J times, so that's order J. How much does the body cost every time you execute? Well, it's order 1 plus order 1. That's order 1 times order J. So that's order J. Clear? See how, you know, much better than oh, C1, C2, C3. Oh, God. Yeah. Life's too short. Okay? So the while loop, that's those lines there, is order J. Okay? Yeah? And now we haven't accounted for the final line. What does that cost? Order 1. See, that's a lot neater, isn't it, than all those C1, C2 rubbish. So the overall cost is what? Order 1 plus order 1 is order 1, plus order 1 is order 1. Order 1 plus order J is what as a function of J? Order J, thank you. Ah, good, yeah, brilliant. Yeah? So that's what the body costs as a function of J, right? Now, what's the maximum value of J? Ever. Sorry? It's order n, yes. It is n, but it's order n, yes? Because, you know, the outer loop is from 1 up to the length of a minus 1. It's n minus 1, but let's not worry about it. It's just order n. Let's be generous, okay? Yeah? Right? So the overall, so big O of j in terms of n is what? Big O of n, because j is never bigger than n, yeah? Okay? That body of the loop is never more than big O of n. How many times is the body executed? We've just done that, actually. Big O of n times, yeah? So the overall cost is big O of n times big O of n. And of course, you're already ahead of me, that's big O of n squared, isn't it? Yes? Isn't that a lot neater than all those damn constants, right? Now, this, of course, might be a severe overestimate. Why? Because I estimated each value of j as being big O of n, but of course when j is 1, the cost is a constant. When j is 2, the cost is a constant, and so on. So have I deluded myself? Maybe the real upper bound should be more like, I don't know, order n log n, or even order n, whatever. Yes. So to convince ourselves that we haven't overestimated, we need to produce a matching lower bound. We need to show that this is big omega of n squared. Yeah. Okay. Well, intuitively, when are things really dreadful for this algorithm? Intuitively, it's when it has to do the maximum amount of work every time it executes that while loop, yeah? And when does that happen? Well, remember what it does. Where am I putting my chalk? God, I'm getting old. Oh, here's a piece here, anyway. Well, you look at this and you say, should I move it down there? If you don't, well, you're finished. So that's obviously not the bad case. It's bad if you say, oh, you've got to move. And then you compare with that, oh, you've got to move. And you always have to go down to the bottom. Translate that, what does that really mean? That means that whatever you look when you're trying to grow the array, what's here is smaller than everything before it. Yes? And that has to hold for every position of the array. If I ask you to write down an array such that every time I go up an index, what I see is smaller than what's gone before, and let me make the entries to be 1 up to n, just to keep it simple, what would the array look like? Thank you, yeah. N minus 1, n minus 2, down to 1. That's obviously going to make things really tough for this algorithm, because it's always got to do the maximum amount of work, hasn't it? Clear? Excellent. We're getting on well. I'll get past this awful slide. Okay, that's the bit we're trying to show. It's a bit harder than showing big O of n squared, but not that tough. You've just seen, you know, we're producing an example input of size n, which will elicit a big omega of n squared behavior. We're not saying that every input of size n elicits this behavior, okay? If the array is already sorted, the runtime is actually big O of n, okay? But, you know, it's got to account for all inputs of size n, okay? So we say, what about this nasty one then, eh? Okay? You said it always runs fast. Here's one, try this one, okay? Yeah, that's what to do to yourselves, man. Okay. Bad instance event, we've done this, okay? So we've seen why this is the bad instance to choose. It's not always quite so simple to choose one, but you know, you basically look at your algorithm and say, what would be really terrible for this? How can I arrange the input to get the maximum work out of it? Okay. And that's what we've just done, okay? Well, then for every J, It's gone, sorry, I forget. That while loop executes j times. It's the maximum number of times. Okay. So the execution is at least as big as sum from j equals 1 up to n minus 1, a constant times j. Because everything else involves a non-zero constant. Right, so take the minimum of those non-zero constants. That gives you a lower bound of it's some constant times j, because you always do j executions. And that's from j equals 1 up to n minus 1. Right? We'll take the constant out. That's a very familiar series, I hope. It's an arithmetic progression. And its value, when you work it out, is just a half n by n minus 1. Is that familiar? Yeah? If it isn't, make sure it is. Okay. There's a good story of oh, no, maybe if I have time. I'll see. Okay. Good story, but maybe. Okay. Yeah? Okay. A very simple fact about arithmetic progressions. Okay. And, of course, now it's a simple matter to show that that is big omega of n squared. Do it. Okay. Don't just say it's anything simple. Do it. Right? It's very simple, really. But do it. Okay. Typical asymptotic running times. The kind of thing we tend to see for algorithms of this kind of level of working. Things like theta log n, logarithmic, and that's when you're doing divide and conquer type things of chopping the array in half or whatever data structure in half and getting rid of half the data with a constant amount of work. Okay, that's the typical runtime you get. Okay, if you're lucky enough to be able to do that, you get a very, very fast runtime, as you've seen with binary search. Theta n is linear, so that's when you have no option but to look at basically every item of your data, but no more than that. Okay? Theta n log n is a very typical running time when you've got to do some kind of n amount of work, but the amount of work you can do with each step is minimized to something like log n, okay, by some kind of divide and conquer. Quadratic is typical of when you can't avoid but have two nested for loops running in about n time. Okay, cubic, again, three nested for loops. Well, degree four, guess what? Okay, that's the kind of thing you get. Okay, and 2 to the n, that's, you don't want to go there if you can help it. That's exponential. That's, you know, but we have problems for which we have no better algorithms. Okay, and really seriously important problems. Okay, but we have no better algorithms in terms of worst case behavior. Okay. I will have time for my little anecdote. Okay, that's just further reading which you can look up on the net. So my little anecdote about the arithmetic series. Do you all know the story about Gauss when he was at school? Some of you do, but some of you don't. Okay, so the story is this. It's that the teacher wanted to have an easy time, so he wrote up the numbers from 1 up to 100 or something and said to the students, to the school pupils, add these numbers up. He thought, this will take them ages, you know, I can relax. So, of course, immediately Gauss works out the formula for arithmetic progression and says, please, sir, it's this. You don't want to have that as a student. Well, it's a pleasure to have such a person as a student, but, you know, not if you're trying to skive off and have an easy time. So, there's a nice story. And I hope one of you turns out to be as good as Gauss. But, you know, that's pretty high. Half as good would be incredible. And so, okay, so, you know, epsilon Gauss would be really good. Okay, so see you next time, and thank you for your attention. Go to the ITO and tell them, ask them to assign you to a group, because they do all the assignments. The ITO floor 4. Yes. So just tell them that, you know, you're not going to assign the group. It's probably just some system or something. You are definitely registered for the course, are you? Okay, so it's just not some oversight. So just go to them tomorrow morning and ask them to assign you to a group. By the way, if there's a tutorial tomorrow, you know, you could just turn up to one tutorial tomorrow and just explain, you know, why you're waiting to be assigned to a group. You're just going to that. I'm not sure if there's any tutorials tomorrow. You'd have to look online and see. But okay. Sorry about that. But, you know.
I'm not here, right? I ain't too.